all the performing arts, classical music has been the most hopelessly bound to past repertory. It's essential for those who want this art form to have a future as well as a history to encourage new work and cajole ensembles, orchestras, and opera companies into supporting living composers. Yet such calls are not meant as a criticism of the standard repertory. These works have survived for a reason. The problem is that repertory staples are trotted out too often for their own good.
So wrote Anthony Tomasini in the New York Times Critics Notebook in 2002. After 10 years, what are the prospects for classical music? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What are the best new performances available today? Who are the composers offering the best hope for classical music? And what's the role of the critic in maintaining the medium? Our guest is Anthony Tomasini, chief music critic for the New York Times.
Welcome to University of the Year.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
You must feel sometimes as if you have a lot of power. I was just thinking about, you know, my son is playing in the St. Mm-hmm. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and they went to New York. And then, you know, they wait to see what is the New York Times going to say about a particular performance. And that's you, usually.
That's you starting with a very delicate question. I mean, in my humble opinion, the Times is the best paper in the world. And I'm very proud to be part of it. And it's a great responsibility. And I know our words mean something and carry. I understand all that. And I'm cognizant of that when I write. But I am me, too. I mean, I just have my take on things, and I want that to come through more than anything else. Now, the part of it that does relate to being at the Times is I think I'm a reasonable guy. I take a big view, look at things in context. If I'm reviewing a new work at the Philharmonic or a new production at the Met Opera or something, or a new artist or a touring group, I mean, what's at stake here? What's the context? Where did this performance originate? What are the artists trying to convey? What's the point? You know, it's not just what I thought, but obviously by virtue of the way I describe it, you're going to figure out what I thought. But it's not as if the editors want there to be a Times point of view at all. You know, they encourage us to have strong, feisty opinions and write in a lively way. And I do. But on the other hand, I know that I understand that a young artist, a young soprano appearing with the New York City Opera or some little company or a the first words about her in the New York Times, I could be writing the first words about her.
And the last.
Well, yeah, I mean, so I am aware of that, you know, but it's a balance. You know, one thing about criticism that I think people don't understand is that it's a combination of opinion piece and news story. It's not 50-50 necessarily. It depends. If I have a strong opinion, that dominates. If I don't have such a strong opinion, I may pull back and describe, account for what I saw. But the news story part of it is a big component. I mean, if there's a new work I'm hearing or a new artist, a new production, I have a lot of work to do. I have to describe it. I have to make it come alive, you know, for people.
Which is hard to do if you're describing music.
Don't get me started on that. The frustration of my job is that it's essentially impossible to describe music in words. I envy tremendously the sports writers because they can assume so much knowledge on the part of their readers. If you're writing about the Yankees, you wouldn't think, for example, of explaining what the designated hitter rule is. Your readers would think, what do you think, I'm an idiot? But in music, even people who go to concerts all the time and love music often are completely intimidated by the inner workings of music. And I can't use a term like chromatic harmony without, you know, feeling like I'm losing 90-95% of my readers. Yet the only words that we have in music that really convey the specifics of it are these. It's this jargon. So you have to work to come up with colloquial, everyday ways to try to convey sound, which is not easy. The easiest kind of writing is when I review opera, because there I'm half theater critic. I mean,
sure.
There's a show, there's costumes, there's, you know, there's acting, and those are just much easier things to write about.
And a storyline.
And a storyline, yeah. And But I try. I do my best. But it's not easy. It's really fudge. I do. But it's really, really hard. It's a very hard thing.
Do you have any issues when you get to know some of these performers? They become friends of yours?
Yeah, that really doesn't happen at the times. I mean, papers are different, and we just don't fraternize. Is that the word? For example, James Levine, just to bring a poor guy who's having health troubles now,
sure, and
is in,
sure,
in a bad way, and now he's out for even the whole of the next season. I think over the years, I think we like each other and respect each other, and I think more than that, I respect him tremendously, and I think he likes me and respects what I do. But over the years, I don't think I've ever had a conversation with him that wasn't in the context of interviewing him in his office for something. I don't socialize. Now, often when I would go, I'd interview him, then we'd turn off the tape and we'd just talk for a half hour about things. But I just would not – it's funny. It's just the way the times is. We just don't associate with people. I mean, except you can have a kind of nice friendly rapport, where that changes sometimes if you go to a festival, especially if it's a small festival, and you wind up eating with in these big communal places.
Seems inevitable some circumstances.
Yeah, and that's all fine. I mean, the times, we're not ridiculous about it, but it just, there is a kind of separation. If somebody really becomes a friend, then I can't write about them. I just can't.
You must have to have a thick skin, because I'm assuming, especially these days where people can post their anonymous comments instantly, that if you come out with a review of something, that you probably get just a stream of vitriolic response at times.
It's amazing how much easier it is for people to reach us now. And that's true. You do get – but, I have to say, not to compliment myself, but I get a lot of wonderful emails from people, really lovely, supportive emails. Then I get a lot of emails saying, I really like you and I like what you do, but I sure think you're wrong about this, which is fine. That's great. But yes, I get really attacked by people too. I'll tell you where, especially the opera people. They're nuts.
They're so emotional.
And their opera blogs and stuff, and they're fanatical, that's another thing about criticism in general and the Times in particular, that I am a pianist by training and I love contemporary music and chamber music and all kinds of music, and I love opera, and I ran an opera workshop when I was teaching in college, and I've accompanied singers, but I'm not some opera crazoid. I'm, I'm a reasonable person who has a more middle ground take on things, and the opera people are so fanatical that it's amazing. It's not how could you be so mean? It's how could you say one good thing about that terrible mezzo soprano?
They tend to be that way rather than why did you pan?
Yes,
this
they
one?
Feel like I'm being too easy or whatever. Because I don't know. I'm probably too reasonable for them. But I mean, there's something to be said for that passion and the involvement, and it's. So I get mostly flack from them.
But you have to really review something on the basis of just one hearing, one impression. It's not like you can go back and hear the, recording
right.
of the opera that you're reviewing.
Right.
And that must be something of a hardship, something of a handicap.
Well, it's also – it defines the genre of what I do. I mean, in a way, I sort of like deadlines because, when my review is due soon – and in a way, what a review is saying is, look, I was there last night. This is what I thought. If I had a week to think about it, maybe I'd feel differently. If I heard it again, maybe I'd feel differently. But if you want my first impression, here it is. It's amazing. My good friend Alex Ross, who's the critic at The New Yorker, and I respect him immensely, and we are good friends. When the Met's new ring was introduced, I wrote the review of Dust Rheingold, and I got an email from him saying, nice review. I'm still, thinking about it. He said he's going to go back, see it again. And I read that, and I thought, wow, that's the difference between his job and my job, that he writes for magazines. So
sure,
often
yeah.
his articles will come out a little bit after the first reviews have. So in a way, it calls for a more reflective overview kind of thing. It's very different than my just saying, this is what happened, you know, and it's my, here's my first report. I once got into a thing on this very question with Ned Rorem, whom I also respect tremendously, and he was talking about critics having the last word on things. I said, gee, Ned, I don't know. I feel it's the opposite. I have the first word, not the last word, you know. And everybody, every musician, every artist, and every critic should read Nicholas Slomninsky's Lexicon of Musical Invective.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's great.
Very entertaining.
Because it's filled with pans of all the great works of the repertoire by the critics of the day, you know.
Or sometimes even fellow composers. Tchaikovsky says about Bizet, for example.
Which must keep everyone humble in the field of criticism if you see how many bad opinions came out, how many misjudgments.
But I love, in that sense, I enjoy most writing about contemporary music. New music, because it hasn't been written about yet. You really need me when there's a new piece. What was it like? You know, it's really hard. Reviewing even the New York Philharmonic doing a good but not, you know, path-breaking or really memorable performance of the Eroica Symphony, but of Beethoven, but, you know, perfectly good performance is a really hard review.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What do you say about something that's been done so many times?
You know, it's like, well, we all know it. We all love it. It happened again. You know, like, it's just...
Well, maybe this is a good time to jump and talk about the opera Anna Nicole, because that's a good example of something where it's a new work.
Right.
And I noticed that your review was entitled "Who Would Have Thought?"
Right. Yeah. Mark Anthony Turnage, the British composer, an excellent composer, has a radical streak, and he's done some pretty outrageous things and lots of just solid instrumental music and vocal pieces. And when I heard about this idea, an opera based on Anna Nicole Smith, I said, it wasn't the sordidness of the story as much as I thought, oh, they're going to make fun of her. That's what it's going to be.
It'll be cheap. Cheap laughs or something.
And it was wonderful. It is funny and real, you know, really bitterly funny sometimes. But they really treat her as an American archetype of a gal who figured out what she needed to do to get ahead. And the music's really outrageous and dynamic, and the libretto's very witty. But it's really quite poignant. And the end of her life was quite tragic, you know. And a lot of things in it really did happen, like marrying the billionaire in his 90s. And I think I said in my review that the Covent Garden people, had its premiere at the Royal Opera at Covent Garden in London early last year, and I went to it. And I think Covent Garden was overdoing the campaign about sex and drugs in the opera. And I said, you know, opera's full of sex, drugs, Wagner. Every Wagner opera is about potions and stuff. And Anna Nicole does break ground, I think. It's the first time opera has depicted breast implant surgery. I think that
that's
was
a new one.
Well, let me ask you this about that then. I mean, and this has been a chronic problem with opera from some of the early performances of La Boheme, for example. Mm-hmm. How can Mimi be wasting away when she obviously weighs 350 pounds?
Right.
And would this be not an issue for something like Anna Nicole, where she's supposed to be beautiful? You haven't got a soprano that convinces you somehow.
Yeah, this is a very big topic. First of all, today's singers know that. They understand this. And they go to the gym, and they understand that opera has to be more theatrical, and these people care more about these values. Which is not to say that throughout the glorious decades of opera, there were not beautiful
people who
were good actresses and actors, you know. But so they do understand that, and I think they're thinking about that more. But opera isn't about that kind. The drama in opera is not that about that kind of literal reality. And there's a little clip from the Bell Telephone Hour in the 50s, I guess it would have been, of Jussi Björling and Renata Tebaldi singing the last scene of Act One of Boheme. You know, his aria, her aria, and then the duet. And, you know, he was no actor, and he looks a little like a dumpy Swedish guy. And she looks like a very pretty, little portly, middle-aged Italian lady. And they start singing, and it's the essence of youth and longing and heartbreak and love at first sight. It's just so extraordinary. And that is the drama, you know, that is actually intensely dramatic. The music really helps you. Then there's also another thing I've noticed that, which is true of acting also. The mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe may be the greatest singer right now in the world. And she, it's astonishing what she can vocally. She's so intense and expressive and smart. She is a big gal, but she takes the stage like she owns the stage. She, as Orfeo in Gluck's Orfeo and Eurydice, you know, just now as Amneris and Aida at the Met, she's just one of these people who is so in to the, whatever role she, Fricka, it's a, and you, she walks on stage, you believe it. And there are actors like that, you know, who just, beyond what they look like.
They
you
carry
just,
the part
they
no
just
matter what.
Carry it, you
when
know.
You have the transcendence, you become something else.
What about the musical style then for Anna Nicole? We have a little bit of it that we can listen to. What do you see as intriguing
about
the music?
Well, he had a way of folding in all the, you know, jazzy, kind of trashy American vernacular stuff, but yet it's so smart. The notes are so smart. The chords just, I mean, at the same time that I was sitting there laughing, or, you know, the music sometimes captures the sort of tawdriness of it, a part of my brain was going, what are those notes? I got to get the score. What is that chord? Wow. You know, what
is, so it was interesting.
So it's real. He's smart, too.
And you were surprised? You went
that,
to it?
I knew. He's a good composer. I thought the music would be good, but I just thought you're not going to be able to save it from if you're just going to make fun of her, you know. But they didn't. Yeah, it was very surprising. I must say, a lot of people didn't agree with me. The London critics did not like it so much, and a couple of American critics didn't like it. But, I thought it was a great production. It was a lot of fun.
Here's some of Anna Nicole.
We will be back with more comments on the state of music in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Anthony Tomasini, who's the chief classical music critic for the New York Times. And I have to wonder a little bit about when you go to review a piece of music, how much credit do you have to give, almost like a handicap, to a performer or even a manager who says, let's try something different, let's try something new?
I'm not sure. You mean, I'm not sure what you're asking.
In other words, if they're trying something that's particularly challenging.
Right. They should get credit for trying, yes. Yeah, I think that's only fair, especially if people like me are going to keep pressuring the institutions to get more with it and more hip and more. You see, my take on this for years, it has been. I think it's changing, partly because of new generation, partly because of new leadership at the institutions, and partly because of critics who've been making this case. But classical music traditionally has been the most conservative of the performing art forms in comparison with ballet or theater, a repertory theater company somewhere that had a season of, let's say, 12 plays. If four of them were new or recent, you know, from the last 10 years, four of them were like mid-20th century plays, and four of them were 19th century or earlier, that would be completely normal season. Can you imagine if a major orchestra had a season where one-third was new and recent works, one-third was like mid-20th century, and one-third was like Brahms and earlier? Hmm. That'd be radical.
Well, it might be financially disastrous for that symphony. I mean, is part of the problem a business one?
Well, that's where this gets complicated. I mean, it's not financially disastrous for the example I'm citing of a repertory theater company. Mm-hmm. So why have audiences. You know, if there have been a drag on this, then we have to do something about the audiences. Then we have to, shake things up, get new people in there. Now, obviously, the one thing about classical music is that we have a lot of old repertoire to take care of, to maintain. But this is a change in the history of music. It didn't, you know, in the days of La Scala, when Verdi was alive, was essentially a new music house, a house that had new and recent, meaning the last 15 years, operas. And every once in a while, something like Don Giovanni done very much in the nature of a special revival. Caruso today would be considered a new music specialist. When you think of all the roles written for him or recent roles, you know, that he didn't premiere, and even when he sang Radames in Aida, that piece was newer than Billy Budd is today. So there has been a big, big shift. And now I'm not asking for all the institutions to become new music ensembles, but the balance is off, that's all. And, you know, boy, I don't mean to get so feisty about audiences because we want to bring audiences in and want them to take a chance. But years ago, about 12 years ago, I guess, the brilliant French pianist Pierre-Laurent Aimard, who's brilliant and plays a lot of contemporary music, gave his Carnegie Hall recital debut. He played the Alban Berg Sonata, the one-movement Berg Sonata, then the Appassionata of Beethoven, then some late Liszt works, then two books of Debussy Image, and then five Ligeti Etudes, five of the amazing piano etudes.
But more demanding.
Who, at the time, Ligeti was still alive. And about 24 people or so at Carnegie Hall walked out before the Ligeti.
Before it?
Before, yeah.
Why?
And, well, they just didn't want to hear the new stuff.
Oh,
and
they walked out before
They walked before
it.
Before it started. And you're supposed to, you know, you should never criticize your audience because they're the very people you're trying to win over to your point of view. But I did in this piece. I said, you know, really, after the way that man played Beethoven and Liszt and Debussy, if he hadn't won you over, if he hadn't, you know, if you didn't want to hear him play anything he wanted to play for you, what are you doing there? I mean, what kind of – plus the pieces are amazing and he plays them amazingly. And it's like I really felt there are plenty of people who probably would like those seats, you know, and would be really eager to hear those pieces. So we have some audience development to do. But that's where leadership is everything. All the studies that have looked at the institutions say that artistic leadership is the whole works.
Artistic meaning management or meaning artists?
Meaning management that is smart enough to get the right artists. So you look at the West Coast. Michael Tisler-Thomas, since 1995, has just been a dynamo at the. And he, when he started his kind of programming, he knew he'd lose some old timers, but he'd brought in new people. And now look what Dudamel is doing. You know, Gustavo Dudamel in Los Angeles, the same thing. The whole town is kind of galvanized by him. And you just want to. He wants to do these adventurous things, and you want to hear them. Now in New York, back home, Alan Gilbert took over in 2009. And whatever you think of Lauren Mazel or Kurt Mazur, who are both major conductors, I had problems especially with Mazel. I was not actually wild about his conducting, but he's obviously a formidable musician, a formidable conductor. But as a leader, as an artistic leader in the city, he had no presence at all. He just didn't care. Alan cares intensely about it. In his own quiet, kind of shy way, he's a great proselytizer, a great teacher. He speaks about music sometimes in concerts before he plays it. He gets the orchestra to play a little bit of what you're about to hear.
I was going to ask about that. We see that more and more, don't we?
I'm all for it.
Artists will break down that barrier a little bit between music and audience.
Audiences love it. And, you know, some people feel, oh, I don't know, I don't have enough personality. But Alan is proof that he's not exactly Mr. Charisma, but he's so earnest and so clear and cares so much that you're just pulled right in.
And a lot of outreach efforts by orchestras that seem to be designed to try to get a more diverse, less elitist crowd.
Absolutely. There's nothing more important than those. And the musicians today, young musicians today, have to learn to do that themselves. Through their websites, you know, through just going out into the community and playing these things. The last season, the Philharmonic did 6 concerts for school students who came to Avery Fisher Hall, and Alan Gilbert conducted all 6. Mm-hmm. Now, he thought, what am I here for? I'm the face of the New York Philharmonic. I should be yeah. the one. And I thought that was great.
Good and then him. You have some fresh responses to the music as yeah. well.
Well, part of that also, it seems to me, that reaching out to new audiences is, as you say, on the back of the artist. And we have a lot of major artists who can, I'll say, afford to say, okay, well, you've heard me do the standard repertory, right. the familiar, the traditional. Now trust me
right.
to perform this piece. I mean, somebody like Renee Fleming.
Even. Right. Now, when it comes to this, this is where I will be critical of artists, even artists I respect, because I don't understand. If you ask Renee Fleming or Don Upshaw or Yo-Yo Ma, any of these major people who do contemporary music, you know, they don't do it out of a It's not a cause. It's not. It's like they. How could you not be interested in new things as well as old things? It's just. It would be like saying, "Oh, I love novels, but only old novels." I mean, that doesn't make sense.
We have sort of a problem with terminology, don't we? When we talk about contemporary music, I mean, term is meaningless,
yeah.
except that the composer presumably is or recently was alive. But I mean, if you compare contemporary music from, say, 30 or 40 years ago
right.
with contemporary music today, you
yes.
find a considerably different kind of thing, and I would say more accessible today than then.
Yeah, well, there are all sorts of things going on at the same time. You're probably right in general to say, you know, talk about accessibility, but, you know, the Brahms Fourth Symphony is a very strange piece of music, you know, and I love it, and we all love it, but I'm not sure I get it. Mm-hmm. Like, my favorite Sibelius symphony is the fourth, because I think I understand it the least.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And it's amazing, you know, so I'm not so sure we understand all these things the way we think they do. It's just that they're familiar, you know, we've heard them so much, and it's funny, this relates to criticism, too, the hardest thing to perceive when you're listening to music is structure, but it's the easiest thing to describe.
True.
So program notes and a lot of reviews are all, this happened, then this happened, and then this happened.
Which I never yeah. find that very interesting.
And, but that when you think of when I was a kid listening to all, getting to know all this stuff, I didn't know sonata form from anything. You know, that's not the way you experience
right.
it. Afterwards, you say, oh, yeah, I see how it's set up.
Some development, you know, some recapitulation.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you. When you're listening to a symphony that you're about to review, do you ever find yourself wandering off in your thoughts even when you're trying not to?
Yeah, I mean, sure. But, I mean, it's amazing how involved I get listening to everything I have to go listen to. And sometimes I get very swept away and I get thrilled by performance, or even if I'm bored, but it's not that I stop listening, but always a part of my brain is always thinking, how am I going to describe this?
Yeah.
You know, how am I going to put this into words? And if I'm not engaged, I'm thinking a little bit more about that. You know, I'm thinking, well, sometimes after 10 minutes, I see what's going on, and I think, okay, how am I going to describe this pianist? You know, what's going on here? And then it becomes like I'm looking for, I can use mm-hmm. that, I can use that.
So you're working.
You're yeah. listening yeah. differently.
You know, people
than
say
most
to
people.
Me, at the most common, oh, your job's so great. You get to hear these things, and you go to Salzburg Festival, and you do all, and I'll say, yeah, but the job is writing about yeah. it. That's the yeah. job part.
And you yeah. have to listen with that in yeah. mind.
You have to go yeah. home
right. it's
later.
Just, I think music for a lot of people does take them away. It takes them
yes.
on journeys.
Yes.
Takes them to, you know, all kinds of memories.
Right.
And it's very evocative.
Yeah.
And that's different from really listening carefully to the you know, the structure or the, you know, each
no,
musician.
No, it takes you out of yourself.
Yeah.
It does. It puts you in a zone. You know, mm-hmm. it can. And but, you know, I'm also interested in the intellectual workings of music. And I'm a musician. And I think that's one of the reasons that music hooks you sometimes. That you know, and the I've often in classes or in one of my videos, I did the analysis of the second movement of the Bach Italian Concerto, where the melody just seems aimless. It just spins and weaves and wanders.
This is a concerto for one instrument.
Yes, for one instrument. It was written for harpsichord, but the left hand very slowly has, you know, a little tune in a sense, in double thirds that you don't notice if you're hearing it in the proper tempo. But if you speed it up and just play the left hand, you get this catchy little tune. So obviously, your part of your brain is hearing that, even if you're not consciously hearing it. That's why the right hand melody doesn't sound like it's just aimless. It's, you know, you just go with it. So there's an intellectual component to that piece. Mm-hmm. So I'm fascinated, and in my experience, pointing that out to listeners enhances their experience of it. It doesn't diminish it. It doesn't make it all mental all of a sudden. They think, oh, wow, listen to that.
No, they just hear more.
You know,
then.
They hear. Yeah. They think, oh, that's what I'm hearing. People, it's funny, they're a little ambivalent about music is so emotional, so powerful, that you both don't want anybody, it's the one thing you don't want to put into words, you know, but yet you're hungry to know, why did it move you so much? I mean, why did it get to me? And
well, I'm always so grateful, whether it's music or art, if someone helps me see more or hear more,
right,
then, you know, I just feel I've been given a gift.
Right.
So if criticism has that role,
right,
where then if someone goes to the concert and they're more alive in how they listen, they see things and hear things that they might have missed.
No, if I'm ever able to do that for anybody reading me or hearing me, I'm very gratified because I'm like you, I appreciate that myself.
If you're looking at a painting and somebody has pointed out this obscure figure in the corner,
right,
who happens to be the artist that was painted in, and you never would have noticed,
right,
it yourself.
Yeah.
It's
but
such a
all
thrill.
Of those little epiphanies, I think, only work if your perceptions are already cued into that. I mean, it's not that it's putting some idea in your head. It's awakening something, mm-hmm, that you may not be consciously aware of, but you are perceiving. You know, the reason you go, wow, is because you probably already did. It was sort of getting to you, mm-hmm, you know, and you think, oh, yeah, that's what it is. I see now, yeah.
There's a line in one of Mozart's letters where he's writing to Leopold, his father, and refers to a piece of music that he's written. And everybody's going to really love this piece for reasons they're not even aware of.
Right. I think I love that quote. It's about these three piano concertos that are not so hard. And he said that he's written them in a way that they're things that only connoisseurs will underappreciate. But, you know, they're very appealing pieces. But everybody, other people will get it without knowing why,
yeah,
you know, which I think is very smart.
He had their number.
Yeah.
One of the artists we were mentioning just a little bit ago was Renee Fleming.
Yeah.
And I gather that there's something that she did that you sort of feel is very admirable.
Well, she, when Alan Gilbert made his debut as music director in 2009, for his concert, opening concert, it was really daring, showed that we're going to have a new era now. He began with the premiere of a piece by the composer in residence, which we hadn't had a composer in residence there for a long time, Magnus Lindberg, terrific piece. Then Renee Fleming was the soloist for this Live from Lincoln Center thing on PBS, televised. And rather than ask her to sing Strauss arias and Mozart arias, he asked her to sing a 30-minute Messiaen song cycle from early Messiaen piece that she didn't know, which she did from memory. And she really got involved with these kind of love poems. And it was just fantastic. And she threw herself into it. And they eventually recorded it. Then the second half of the program was the Symphonie Fantastique.
Berlioz.
Mm-hmm. And somehow after those first two pieces, Alan was able to make the Berlioz seem also crazy and wild, and which it is, but you forget that in sometimes in performances. So yeah, I was impressed that Renee Fleming did that, and it was took guts. And now there's a new recording in which a work written for her also by Henri Dutilleux, the French composer, and then another French work, Ravel Scheherazade. So beautiful, beautiful recording, and she's so good in 20th century or contemporary work. I wish she did even more of it, but she's done a lot. She's done her share. But
and how do you describe her voice? You said it's hard to put music into words. You have to describe Renee Fleming as opposed to any other singer. What kinds of adjectives do you throw at her?
Yeah, it's hard with voices because they change over time too. You know, they evolve, and it's a very creamy, rich sound with a wonderful bloom to it. And she has had, in her early days especially, she had all this wonderful coloratura agility. And she probably kept singing some of that repertoire a little longer than she should have because she lost some of that agility. She can't do it as easily as she used to. It's not a big voice, but it carries beautifully. Now, the issue that she's had criticism over is that some people find her a little fussy, a little mannered, a little too affected in her interpretation of it. But I once did we have this series called Times Talks, and I did one with her. And we took on that issue, and we listened to four recordings of a monologue from Der Rosenkavalier, the Marschallin, with Lotte Lehmann and Maria Reining and Elizabeth Schwarzkopf and then Renee. And it was amazing to me, for all the criticism that Renee Fleming has gotten over her fussiness, guess which of those four was the most rhythmic, most rhythmically accurate by far? Absolutely, Renee Fleming. Absolutely. You know, the liberal rhythmic singing and the other, I mean, although they were all beautiful in their own way and very expressive, but if anything, she was the most straightforward.
The voice of Renee Fleming with the French Radio Philharmonic Orchestra led by Alan Gilbert, and that was the beginning of the poem Pour Me by Olivier Messiaen. We'll be back with New York Times chief classical music critic Anthony Tomasini and some of his other favorite performers and performances when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Anthony Tomasini, chief classical music critic for The New York Times. And we're talking about many things, but including sort of the state of music today. You mentioned that your background was as a pianist.
Yes,
and that must make it, in a way, easier when you're reviewing a performance by different pianists today.
Yeah, you might think that it would make me super critical or something. Because I'll hear something and think, well, I played it differently, you know. The whole idea that critics are frustrated performers or something is crazy. That's just not true. I just don't know people who like that. And nothing excites me more than hearing the piano play beautifully. And if anything, my knowledge of the piano makes me, if anything, maybe a little even more sympathetic. I know how hard it is.
More appreciative.
You know, I'm the last critic to say a pianist had a memory lapse for a moment or got tangled in something or a soprano cracked on a note or something. Unless it happens a lot during a performance, then it seems indicative of a problem. But I've been there. I know how hard it is. But I love hearing the piano play beautiful, and I do, you know, I hear a lot of great pianos.
And what artists stand out for you today?
Well, there are many. I like Andrzejewski, I think, is tremendous. Christian Zimmermann, I'm a big fan. But one of my real favorites right now is the Norwegian Leif Ove Andsnes, partly because there's something beautifully self-effacing about his playing. Technically, it's fantastic. Every note counts. There's no wasted anything. I mean, everything has a voice in his performances. But for some people, it might be a little cool. But that's sort of what I like, because it's like a gift. It's like he's saying, let me show you how this piece goes. You know, it's not about me. It's about this music. And so then when he does, like, milk a phrase of Chopin a little bit, it's overwhelming because he does it. He saves it.
You know, he has a reason for that.
Yeah.
Is there a sample we can listen to show the...
I think we have his recording of the pictures at an exhibition of Mussorgsky.
Yes, we started with that, in fact. And it's a fascinating piece because so many of us are so familiar with the Ravel orchestration, which came much later.
Yeah, I much prefer the piano version myself, although I love Ravel. But the very opening prelude, you know, Promenade, the first piece is very telling. Ansnes plays it like a chorale. All the voices and the chords are equal, have, you know, weight behind them. It's so straightforward and direct. It's just, like, very bracing. And in a way, not at all fancy. He's not fooling around at all. It's just straightforward and takes your breath away.
Does almost evoke voices, doesn't it? That chorale.
Yes, it's like a Russian choir or something.
And in evaluating what part of that is the performer, there is this really round, rich sound in the playing there. But then you have to get into the question of how much of that is the instrument that he's using.
This is where my insider piano stuff. You know, it's very interesting to be at a competition where pianist after pianist comes out and plays the same piano.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how different the same piano can sound when different people play it. There's a lot to getting sound out of a piano. Obviously, a piano also has built-in qualities that you can't fiddle with too much, but it's amazing.
Well, the fascinating thing is the variety of performances that a given pianist can give you.
Right.
Mussorgsky is almost a thing unto himself.
Right.
There's relatively little piano music of Mussorgsky other than pictures.
Right.
So in a sense, there's not a lot to go on, but if you're comparing the way Lefova Ansnes plays another composer entirely, what does he have going for him if he's playing Mozart, for example?
Well, he has a pretty wide and interesting repertoire, but Mozart, it's the same qualities with him. It's always very straightforward, and this piece I think we're going to play, the concerto in number 9 in E-flat, I heard he had for years he ran a festival in Risør, a tiny little fishing village on the east coast of Norway, where the biggest venue they had was this broke wooden church where if you broke all the fire laws, you could fit about 500 people in there. And Norwegian Chamber Orchestra played on the, actually, that was the Risør Festival strings played on stage, on the altar, sort of. And the piano fit in between the two rows of seats. You know? And that's the first time I ever heard him play this, and it was amazing. Just the honesty, the integrity of every little turn, every little ornament, every little piece of passage work. There's passage work goes out the window in a performance by him of Mozart because the notes matter. You know, they all speak. It's just very beautifully rendered and honest and full of life.
that's really intricate work, isn't it? It's dazzling.
Yeah, wonderful.
I know one of the composers who was recently featured here in Madison, William Bolcom, is someone that you've also written about.
Yes.
Can you say something about him and set up that masterpiece?
He has terrific craft and skill, just, you know, the nuts and bolts of composing. He's got that down. But his kind of distinguishing feature, I think, is that he pulls in different music of different styles, almost without exception, for some reason, you know, for some expressive musical purpose, not just to do it, not just to be clever. You know, even popular song or old dances, tangos, whatever, and rock bands and stuff. But all his life he was fascinated by the poems of Blake, Songs of Innocence and Experience. And he set them all in this humongous piece for chorus and for voices and orchestra and various instruments, you know, electronic instruments, a rock band.
This is more than 2 hours.
It's a huge piece. And what fascinates me, it's never gimmicky. I always feel like that he chooses some kind of pop music style as an entry into one of those poems says so much about the poem, the way he reads the poem. It's like, that is an interesting take on that poem. That's what I love about it. You feel like it's not only that the music is breathtaking and audacious, you really are in the presence of a artist who's completely engaged by this poetry. Example, The Little Black Boy. You'd think that some composers might be a little ginger about, you know, the text of that poem. He just plunges right in, and you hear the jazz guitars and the blues and stuff. It's really just a very respectful and insightful take on the poem.
I think there's a harmonica in here.
Yeah,
isn't
harmonica,
there?
Yeah.
The southern wild, but I am black, but oh, my soul is white. White as an angel is the English child, but I am black as though bereaved of light. My mother taught me underneath a tree, and sitting down before the heat of day, she took me on her lap and kissed me, and pointing to the east began to say, look on the rising sun, there God does live, and gives his light and gives his away, and flowers and trees and beasts and men receive comfort in morning, joy in the noonday, and we are put on earth a little space.
Another composer who has worked with the words of William Blake is a composer not only that you've worked with, but you actually recorded some of his music. It was Virgil Thompson.
Yes, I knew him for the last 10 years of his life. He died in 1989. I wrote a major biography of him, and he sort of was a mentor to me when in my early days as a critic, because he was one of the best critics ever. But yeah, he was one of the writers he was most drawn to was Gertrude Stein. And what's wonderful about his settings of Stein is that he treated those words like they made absolute sense and just, you know, and set them with impeccable clarity and incredible, almost shocking simplicity. And I made a couple of recordings of his music as a pianist and one with a bunch of singers. There's this one song I just love called Susie Asado by Gertrude Stein. And it's for a song from the mid-20s, think of what music from the 20s is more radical than this in its incredible simplicity. It's almost radical simplicity. And the text begins, "Sweet, sweet, 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 sweet tea, Susie Asado."
Sounds like Gertrude Stein. And who's our singer here?
And singer is the soprano Nancy Armstrong, and I'm playing the piano.
Well, it's a nice change of pace to bring the critic in as the performer there. My guest has been Anthony Tomasini. He's the chief classical music critic for the New York Times, and it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks so much. I had a lot of fun.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.